Good morning. My name is Michael Astrew, and I'm the Commissioner of Social Security. Welcome to this outreach hearing on compassionate allowances for people with rare diseases. I appreciate your joining us at this critical time as we try to improve the way we make decisions about disability claims. Our top priority is to reduce the backlog of disability cases. This is America, and it is simply not acceptable for Americans to wait years for a final decision on a claim. We are overdue for change, and we are committed to developing processes that are as fair and as speedy as possible. To achieve this goal, we have taken, or will take soon, a number of steps to better manage our workloads. The program includes four components. One, accelerating reviews of cases likely or certain to be approved. Two, improving our hearing procedures. Three, increasing adjudicatory capacity. And four, increasing efficiency through automation and improved business processes. Today's hearing focuses on the first of these components, accelerating the review of cases likely or certain to be approved. When Congress first enacted Title II, to a large extent, it viewed the program as a fairly limited one, directed primarily at a fairly small number of middle-aged workers who needed a bridge to early retirement. Today, our disability programs are far larger and more diverse than Congress initially envisioned. Title II and Title 16 are critical to people from all walks of life, including children born with serious defects, wounded warriors returning with traumatic physical and psychological injuries, and the homeless, and many others. By comparison, the way that we process medical information to define disability has not changed in any fundamental way for decades. We divide our listings into 14 body systems, and we only update those
listings. Excuse me, Ms. Bronstein? Hello?
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 So it almost like
these
mics.
All right. Are
Hello?
Right?
Yes? This is Diane.
Hello?
This is Diane.
Diane, has the call started? Because we're not hearing anything.
We've just asked them to speak directly into the microphone, so hopefully that will alleviate any problems.
Yeah, because we're not hearing nothing.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yep.
I'll try to speak a little bit more closely in the microphone. I was forewarned that there had been some microphone issues. Can you hear me in the back anyway? Yes, okay, good. All right. We don't usually overhaul the listings unless we do comprehensive overhauls, which sometimes wait decades. Our recent release of updated digestive regulations, which include diseases of the liver and colon, were last revised in 1985. We've also tended to focus on large diseases and conditions. This model worked perfectly fine in 1970, but it doesn't work today, and it surely will not work in the coming decade as we process a predicted 26 million disability claims. We need to be more efficient and more accurate. When people don't receive their benefits in as timely a manner as possible, it undercuts the contributions they have made to the system and can continue to make to our society. Getting people benefits quickly is the right thing to do, especially since claimants are often in medical and financial distress. Recognizing distress and wanting to alleviate it is how the dictionary...
Excuse me, is someone online?
Yes.
Ma'am, it is very poor quality. I do apologize, but we're reading about every fourth or fifth word that he is saying.
Okay, we might be having a technical difficulty at this time.
Could you tell her that every time she calls in, she's interrupting the hearing?
If you wouldn't mind, every time you call in, it's actually interrupting. So there are some transcriptionists taking notes that we will be posting online. If there's difficulty with actually hearing the conference, it will be online, available later after the conference.
Okay, now you do realize that it is being recorded on our end.
Yes.
So it's, okay, all right. Okay, we will let them know.
Thank you.
I was talking to the staff right before we started, and I said, well, you know, when we look back on this after 2 days, I'm sure there'll be a few kinks. I just didn't think they'd happen in the first 2 minutes. So I apologize to everybody. Many of you know from personal experience, I know I do, that uncertainty during the long wait for a decision on a family member's case can make a bad decision, bad situation even worse. We're trying to change our business model based on some very simple propositions. First, we need to update our listings much more often, and we need to greatly expand the number of diseases and conditions which are included in our listings. Guidance for one rare disease affecting 50,000 Americans will not make a significant change on the overall process. But if over time we can do it for between 100 to 500 rare diseases, we start to make a real difference. These are precisely the types of cases where examiners are uncertain as to what to do. This uncertainty leads to requests for time-consuming and expensive consultations, often performed by doctors that are unfamiliar with our rules and regulations. In particular, this is why our first hearing focuses on rare diseases. If the process can be improved for children and adults with rare diseases, it can be improved for everyone. Second, we need to fast-track the cases that are certain or near certain to be allowed, and with our new electronic systems, we can automatically and with precision pull those cases out of the queue for fast processing. Our initial test of this concept in New England was highly successful, even though the model only included a handful of cancers, ALS, and low birth weight babies. If we do the hard work of identifying the hundreds, perhaps thousands of similarly situated diseases and conditions, which is what you're all here today to help us with, and for which I thank you, then we may be able to process up to 15% of our cases in days or weeks instead of months or years. Our quick disability determination system, which is one method we are using to fast track cases, has helped us decide cases in the New England region in an average of 11 days. That system has just gone national. We're going to drive the current 3% threshold for likely allowances up with your help in 2008. QDD deals with cases that are extremely likely, more than 90%, to be allowed. We're also moving to create a category of conclusively presumptive disabilities called compassionate allowances. In other words, diseases and conditions where we know, by definition, that the patient will be unable to work for at least 12 months. Third, we need to tap into medical advances of the past decade to make some of our current high volume cases automatic and easy. There have been stunning developments with imaging and biomarkers that should help us correlate objective information with the functional capacity determination necessary to make decisions regarding disability. Can we measure progression of MS by measuring neuronal scarring with MRI? Can the newest imaging machines help us tie blood flow to the heart with functional capacity? We have never investigated the answers to these types of questions, but we have started. As you listen to today's witnesses, as you hear testimony from medical experts, you will hear from testimony from medical experts from NIH. Over the past several months, SSA has been working with the National Institutes of Health to lay the foundation for a partnership designed to provide our adjudicators with modern, up-to-date tools and the cutting-edge medical information needed to expedite disability claims. Dave Russ, Glenn Sklar, and Diane Bronstein in ODISP, and many other SSA and DDS staff across the nation have been working hard to move our disability initiatives from concepts to realities by the middle of next year. As terrific as their work has been, we cannot do it alone. Already, we have received tremendous support from our partners in the state DDSs, advocacy groups, NIH, OMB, and many others. We will continue to need this help as we move forward. A few minutes ago, I mentioned a partnership with the National Institutes of Health. As part of that effort, joining me on the panel to my left is Stephen Groft, director of the NIH Office of Rare Diseases. Steve is taking a great deal of time out of his busy schedule to attend the hearing. I'd like to afford him the opportunity to make a few opening remarks. Steve?
Thank you very much, Commissioner Astru, for this opportunity to join you at these hearings on compassionate allowances for patients with rare diseases. Back in 1987, we had what was called the National Commission on Orphan Disease in our very first meeting. As we were traveling into Washington to convene the meeting, the snowstorm had started that day, shut down Washington maybe for 2 or 3 days. and we had a captured audience. So I think we will release the audience here after 2 days. But that was probably our best meeting that we had as a commission. We were able to bring the thoughts together. So sometimes through adversity, some very, very good things do occur. More importantly, I'd like to express a sincere thank you for the willingness to address this concern. This need for special consideration for rare diseases was expressed by the National Commission on Orphan Disease at the Department of Health and Human Services, convened at the request of Congress and submitted a report back to Congress in 1989. A review and discussion of rare diseases is extremely difficult. There are approximately 7,000 inherited and acquired rare diseases affecting between 25 million to 30 million people in the United States alone. There is no one predictable pattern of progression of many of these disorders that may eventually lead to disability. However, for many other rare diseases, the progression can be predictable and is extremely dramatic. There are many distinguished presenters who have indicated a willingness to provide their experiences in the form of testimony during the next 2 days. I'm sure you've heard from many others who are unable to join us today. When I use the term distinguished, it refers to the commitment and accomplishments of these individuals have made to support research and information development and dissemination activities to advance the knowledge about their rare disease. The patient advocacy groups are now considered to be partners with the research community in their quest for diagnostics and treatment interventions. We will hear numerous suggestions for possible paths to follow as you determine the best choice to address the issue. I think I can say with a certain confidence that whatever path you choose, there will be numerous clinicians, researchers, experienced lawyers, and patient advocacy groups supporting your position and assisting in ways beyond your imagination. They have done so for research during the past 25 years since the Orphan Drug Act was signed in 1983, and I would anticipate the same type of commitment and cooperation in this endeavor as you move forward. I would also like to compliment the Social Security Administration staff members who have worked diligently to address the issues surrounding the proposed program. They have generated the excitement that is necessary to sustain this initiative. We at NIH, including the institutes and the categorical research institutes and centers, and the National Library of Medicine, look forward to the opportunity to continue the collaborative efforts to help meet the needs of patients with rare diseases and their families, who frequently are the primary caregivers for so many with rare diseases. I thank you for this opportunity to participate, and I don't know of any other initiative in the past 10 or 15 years that has generated this much excitement in the rare disease community. So you have your willing partners, and we're looking forward to the outcome of this meeting and other actions of the administration. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. Flanking me on the right and left are Dave Rust and Frank Cristato. I'd like to give them just a chance to briefly introduce themselves and tell you what they do.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm Frank Cristato, Chief Administrative Law Judge for Social Security. I've been an Administrative Law Judge for 17 years as a judge in a hearing office, as a hearing office chief judge, as a regional chief judge, and now as the chief judge. Under the executive leadership of Lisa DeSoto, the Deputy Commissioner for the Office of Disability Adjudication and Review, I'm responsible for management oversight of the hearing operation for Social Security. Thank you.
I'm Dave Rust. I'm the Executive Secretary of the agency, and since August, I've been the Acting Deputy Commissioner for Disability and Income Security Programs. That's the policy shop in Social Security, and I look forward to hearing the testimony today, and we're going to work closely with the Commissioner on converting the information we received today into the policy framework needed to implement this initiative.
Thank you. Over the course of the day, we're going to examine how compassionate allowances can be implemented for individuals with rare diseases. This examination will include the perspectives of the advocacy, adjudicatory, and medical technology community. So thanks again to everyone for coming to today's public hearing. Whether you are here in person or listening in over the phone, perhaps with difficulty, I gather, I invite you to submit your thoughts about today's proceedings to the Compassionate Allowances mailbox at compassionate.allowances@ssa.gov. Let me do that again. compassionate.allowances@ssa.gov. Again, we appreciate your choosing to be a part of this process toward improving what we do in the disability area. I'd now like to invite the first panel, which will provide an overview of rare diseases, to step to the table and kick off our hearing. Let me welcome Diane Dorman, Paul Lipkin, and Sissy Langford. Diane Dorman is Vice President for Public Policy for the National Organization for Rare Disorders. Dr. Paul Lipkin directs the Center for Development and Learning at the Kennedy Krieger Institute and is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He is testifying today on behalf of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And Noni Langford, chair of the Committee on Federal Legislation for the National MPS Society, and is a caregiver for her two children with rare diseases. Thank you all. Welcome. And we'll begin with Diane.
Good morning, Commissioner. My name is Diane Dorman, Vice President for Public Policy for the National Organization for Rare Disorders. And on behalf of NORD and the millions of Americans affected by rare diseases, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today regarding the Social Security Administration's desire to improve the rules for compassionate allowances for individuals affected by rare diseases. As mentioned in our written comments submitted to the Social Security Administration this past September, the men, women, and children seriously affected by rare diseases, many of which are severely debilitating and or life-threatening, are routinely denied Social Security disability insurance and are forced to go through the lengthy and often expensive appeals process. This is because nearly 100% of the rare diseases are not in the SSA listing of impairments, nor are they included in the UN's International Classification of Diseases. In many cases, initial denials of benefits is reversed following appeals, but not before patients and their families have lost precious time and spent thousands of dollars on legal assistance. Rather than discussing the course of individual rare diseases for the most part, I would like to provide a panoramic, kind of a 10,000-foot view of rare diseases. Now, according to the Office of Rare Diseases at NIH, there are approximately 7,000 known rare diseases, each of which affect fewer than 200,000 people in the U.S. The NIH estimates that in the aggregate, between 9 and 10% of the U.S. population has been diagnosed with one of these rare diseases, disorders, or syndromes. 85 to 90% of known rare diseases are chronic, serious, and/or life-threatening. Approximately 80% of these diseases are genetic. Consequently, I make the assumption that children are inordinately impacted by these diseases. This is evidenced by the fact that about 50% of the over 300 orphan products are approved for pediatric use. The diagnosis of a rare disease often takes years. Little evidence is available to support a diagnosis. Experts in the field are few and far between, and doctors know little of these diseases. As a result, patients and their families are shuffled from one specialist to another. In a survey NORD conducted with Sarah Lawrence College several years ago, 42% of the respondents said that they were prevented from working because of their disease. The survey was sent to about 15,000 people with a response rate of 9%. In the same survey, 77% of the respondents said their rare disease had caused them or their families a financial burden. 32% characterized the burden as extreme. Many rare disorders have no surrogate endpoints, markers, or tests. Some are diagnosed based on clinical observations only, others by genetic tests. Before closing, I would like to share with you one of the difficulties that have been described to me by one of the leaders of NORD's member organizations. I will focus only on Marfan's disease syndrome at the moment, and additional information is available in my written comments about other diseases. On November 3, 2004, another member of our group lost her fight with Marfan syndrome. And believe me, she fought hard. She was 39 years old. She has spent the months since February 2004 trying to prepare her son for her ultimate death, make arrangements for him to be taken care of after her death, and try to get Social Security disability so she could take care of him while she lived. Just last week, Social Security denied her for the second time. Honest to Pete, I don't know how they could do that. If they read her medical records and learn she still had a dissection that was not repaired at the time of the emergency surgery, that she could not walk even 15 feet without becoming totally out of breath, that she bled into her right leg if she stood too long, and she had suffered a heart attack, and she had Marfan syndrome, how could they deny her? Please, someone explain to me how the blazes they could turn her down. This woman had no means to provide for her son and herself except for the goodness of other people. She tried to work and just could not. Up until the time she had her emergency dissection, she worked manual labor jobs, such as hand loading semis at a distribution warehouse to take care of her and her son. She did this because no one ever told her that she should not lift heavy things, especially not repetitive lifts. Now I hope her family sends her obituary to the person who wrote the denial and asks them what might have been done had they missed her request for help. It just does not seem that our system of helping people is working. This is just one example of the types of frustrations, delays, and unnecessary expenses often experienced by people with serious and even life-threatening diseases who apply for disability assistance. Several other examples are available in my testimony, written testimony. When Commissioner Astru spoke at the NORD annual conference in September, he emphasized that the impetus for change comes from SSA and not from external sources. In other words, SSA truly desires to provide better service to claimants who are currently being subjected to unnecessary, emotionally draining, and costly delays. NORD applauds his proactive approach and wants to assure all involved that we and our medical advisors will support SSA in the effort to improve its service for patients with rare diseases in any way that we can. Thank you, Commissioner, and I'd also like to extend a very special thanks to Diane Bronstein and Mary Chattel. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. I think what we're going to do here, I think we may have been unclear on the procedure. I think we're going to try to discipline ourselves and hold our questions until all three panelists have testified, because I think when we have our questions, my guess is that two or three of you are going to want to comment on many of our questions. So we're going to hold our questions to the end, and we'll move now to Dr. Lipkin.
Thank you, Commissioner, and good morning. Again, my name is Paul Lipkin. I'm an assistant professor of pediatrics and a developmental pediatrician specializing in the care of children with disabilities at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. There, I'm director of the Center for Development and Learning at the Kennedy Krieger Institute, which is a university center for excellence in developmental disabilities that's completely dedicated to the care of children with disabilities and related medical conditions. I'm also speaking as a media past chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Children with Disabilities. As someone who takes care of children who are eligible for disability benefits from Social Security on a daily basis, I come today with firsthand experience knowing the struggles families can face when accessing benefits. This includes prolonged waits for determination involving extensive information gathering, examination, and for the family's uncertainty regarding their child and his or her future. This is just one more burden for families who must struggle with their child's health, education, and therapies every day. I look forward to hearing Sissy Langford's experience as a parent working with her pediatrician and with Social Security. I made a point today of wearing this particular tie. It was designed by a 13-year-old child who I've known since approximately the age of three. Emily is a happy, smiling 13-year-old child who, in the course of her 13 years of life, has had 35 neurosurgical procedures for some of the congenital brain abnormalities. So this is, for me, a reminder of the children that I'm representing here today. The 60,000 members of the American Academy of Pediatrics are on the front lines with families in diagnosing and treating children with rare diseases and other disabilities that limit their ability to function and develop in the same manner as their peers. The Academy has had a long history of identifying and caring for children and youth with special health care needs and of supporting the SSI program as a way to help children and families with resources and access to needed medical coverage through Medicaid. As an example, I bring this booklet that the Academy has put together with the Social Security Administration on understanding SSI eligibility for children. That's a vital tool for pediatricians in the process. We've also authored policy statements specifically geared towards pediatricians to make them better understand and to support the SSI program for families and children that they are working with. We are actually in the midst of revising this policy, and hopefully in 2008 we'll see new support for pediatricians in this regard. For a family with a child facing the need for increased health care services, frequent medical appointments and tests, prescription medications, medical devices, structured educational services, and social supports, the resources provided through the SSI program and its linkage to Medicaid can be an enormous benefit. Indeed, it can make the differences for families and preserve the ability to remain in care. The first thing that a child diagnosed with a rare disease or other severe medical condition needs is access to health care in a medical home. The medical home is our approach to primary health care that ensures that children's health care services are comprehensive, high quality, and coordinated with community services. In fact, the medical home model was first developed as a model for children like those we are talking about today, children with special health care needs. For all children, but especially children with disabilities, coordinated care that connects them to all necessary health and community resources through a medical home is essential to maximizing their health and functioning. The medical home is also an important linkage between families and Social Security. Pediatricians play an important role in identification and encouraging families to apply for benefits on behalf of their children. They also provide the evidence Social Security needs to determine eligibility and advocate for families during the determination process. The pediatrician can provide the critical information needed regarding how a child lives every day with his or her rare disorder and or disability and how he or she best relates to their peers and to the people that they relate to every day in school. Enhancing the relationship between Social Security and a child's medical home should be an important part of any policy change Social Security is considering to streamline the application process. Beyond the diseases and conditions already in the published medical criteria used by Social Security to determine eligibility, it's challenging to identify the additional number of children that could be made eligible under a new category of compassionate allowance. We know that children with special health care needs make up approximately 12.8% or 9.4 million children and youth in the United States. This means that approximately one out of every five homes in the United States has a child or youth with special health care needs living there. This does not mean that these children are now or will ever be disabled, according to the Social Security's standard of severity and duration as currently outlined. Similarly, a child diagnosed with a rare disease or disorder may have immediate functional deficits, no functional deficits, or may be at risk of diminished functional capacity as they age. The critical issue from the pediatrician's perspective is that processing of an SSI application should be as expeditious as possible, linked closely with the child's medical home. Care should be taken to ensure that only the minimal numbers of duplicate medical appointments or diagnostic tests necessary are required. Children and families with disabilities, including rare disorders, face an array of complex and demanding network of healthcare providers and community resources. A medical home can help to coordinate and streamline this to the extent possible. Social Security should be willing to work with the medical home to gather needed medical evidence, thereby reducing the burden on children and families. I believe we're on the cusp of an important new era in healthcare for children. We now can better identify children with rare disorders with exotic names such as mucopolysaccharidoses, ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency, Gaucher's disease. Thanks to the advances in neuroscience and genetics, we can now identify these children earlier, provide new, albeit expensive, specialized medical treatments, and thus improve their short and long-term health, social integration, and daily functioning in ways not previously available. We also expect these advances to continue in the coming decades. The compassionate allowance program being considered will spare these families prolonged uncertainty and unnecessary hardship and delay. We look forward to your consideration of these factors. Thank you for the opportunity to address these issues. I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you. I've got an update that the phone line apparently is working well, but I've been asked to stress to speak as loudly as you can, as close to the microphone as possible, and I'll try to live up to my own guidance too. Thanks, Sissy.
Thank you, Social Security Commissioner Estu, for this opportunity to represent the National MPS Society and to talk with you about my family and our experiences navigating the disability determination approval process for Social Security. Thanks for making me feel so welcome here today. I feel strongly that children with MPS can teach all of us the important role the government plays in caring for people with severe disabilities, and I appreciate this opportunity to share my thoughts with you. My name is Sissy Langford. I am an elected board member of the National MPS Society. I chair the Committee on Federal Legislation. My committee acts as a liaison between Congress and government agencies and our general membership. The National MPS Society is a nonprofit 501c3 family support organization. Our goal is to ultimately find a cure for MPS disorders by supporting research and providing support to individuals and their families affected by MPS, and more importantly, by promoting public and professional awareness of these disorders. Due to the often short life expectancy of people affected with MPS, the majority of our affected members are children and their families. Our membership does also include a small percentage of adults who suffer from MPS. Some children are considered mildly affected while others seek treatments which have drastically improved their qualities of life. Some examples of new treatments are the enzyme replacement therapy and bone marrow transplant and cord blood stem cell transplant. These have made tremendous differences in the lives of these children. These treatments are not cures, and they're not available for all MPS children. I recognize that these factors make it difficult to set policy for the Social Security Administration benefit approval process. The mucopolysaccharidosis, or MPS disorders, are genetically determined lysosomal storage diseases. They result in the body's inability to break down enzymes. Basically, the enzymes are stored within the cells in the body, and over time they damage these cells and eventually destroy the cells. Storage causes progressive cell damage in multiple systems within the body, including respiratory, bones, internal organs, heart, and central nervous system, and significant cognitive delay. The results of the damages include mental retardation, short stature, corneal damage, joint stiffness, loss of mobility, speech and hearing impairment, heart disease, hyperactivity, chronic respiratory and digestive problems, and most importantly, drastically shortened lifespans. My 12-year-old son Joe and my 11-year-old daughter Maggie suffer from Sanfilippo syndrome, or MPS3. It is a result of a genetic recessive mutation in both mine and my husband's DNA. There's a 1 in 4 chance that each one of our children will have a mutation that causes MPS3. Because of the extensive central nervous system involvement, there are currently no treatments available for children with MPS3. We live on Johns Island in South Carolina near Charleston, where we receive very good state and county level services and have access to a medical university for the management of this disorder. I've learned that many other families do not have the same level of care we have available in South Carolina and do not experience the same level of success we have had with getting benefits for these children. Joe was born in February 1995 and developed normally except for frequent ear infections and frequent diarrhea. Maggie was born in August 1996, they're 19 months apart, and also appeared to be a normal, healthy child. Joe started dropping words out of his vocabulary at around age 3, at a time when he should have been gaining words, and our pediatrician noticed that his spleen was enlarged, which was an indication of a storage problem. Our pediatrician referred Joe to a geneticist for testing and to the BabyNet program in May of 1998. The diagnosis process took over a year, and during that time we realized that Maggie was experiencing similar decline. Joe and Maggie were officially diagnosed with Sanfilippo syndrome in June 1999. My husband and I researched these MPS disorders, and we were devastated by what we learned. Joe and Maggie seemed mostly normal, so we could not imagine the decline that we read as described in the research. Now, Joe and Maggie depend on wheelchairs completely for mobility. They are no longer verbal and have lost their ability to swallow. They do not laugh or cry. They both rely completely on feeding tubes for nutrition. They have heart defects and they are treated for seizures. They also take medications for sleep and to control agitation and involuntary movement. They are seen regularly by cardiologists, neurologists, gastroenterologists, orthopedists, and other specialists. Joe and Maggie are now developmentally about 12 months old because of those significant cognitive involvement from MPS-3. And they will continue to decline as MPS causes more medical problems. Children with MPS-3 have a life expectancy of an average of 14 years. It is our hope that Joe and Maggie will live longer than average and that they can continue to enjoy an acceptable quality of life. It is an overwhelming challenge to provide our children with an acceptable quality of life due to their decline and their current level of care required to keep them as healthy as possible. Our family's ability to manage the care of Joe and Maggie is a direct result of the services we receive from the state of South Carolina, which includes funding from the federal government. The process begins with the Social Security Administration's determination of eligibility. Many families fail to realize the importance of determining eligibility early in their child's lives. MPS disorders are all degenerative, which makes it difficult for parents, teachers, and medical providers to accept that an active, vocal, mobile child will lose these skills. My husband and I were reluctant to apply to the Social Security Administration for the disability determination because we had not accepted the reality of our children's condition and because we felt we should be able to handle our family's medical needs with our private insurance and our personal resources. The early interventionists and other health professionals working with us recognized that we struggled with this diagnosis, and they consistently persuaded us to prepare for the future. We were strongly advised to pursue any services available to our family. The process was long and complicated. While Joe was accepted through the SSA for Medicaid and the waiver, Maggie was declined because she was not delayed enough. I had to appeal this decision and attended a hearing in order to get Maggie on the waiting list for services. I had to learn my rights and how to get my doctors to write meaningful letters to describe our situation. This took several years. Our local agencies recommended other funding programs and encouraged us to apply for grants to pay for diapers, which were over $350 a month during this long delay to get through the approval process and off the waiting lists. I've included a description of the state-provided services and budget for Joe and Maggie just to give you an idea of how it looks from our point. I'm sure you guys already know most of this, but Joe and Maggie are covered under the TEFRA, or Katie Beckett waiver, which is a category for children under the age of 19, and is designed to keep the child in the home instead of in the community or hospital setting. We applied for the TEFRA program for both kids in October of 99. Joe was made eligible about a month later in November of 99 and was placed on the waiting list in slot number 12. Maggie was denied that eligibility in May 2000, and the hearing to appeal the denial was in August of 2000. At that point, Maggie was ruled eligible. Both children began getting services under MRMD waiver in February 2003. So this process took from October 99 to February 2003. Joe's estimated budget for the 2006-2007 year is $69,000, and Maggie's is $79,000. That does not reflect the amount of money our private insurance pays out, which is 80% of the billing for medical needs. The children are eligible for additional nursing hours, but it's hard to find more nursing care at this time. The budget reflects the nursing care and personal care assistance we use, not the total that they are eligible for. But even at this extensive level of assistance, we have completely altered our lifestyles to care for our children, including moving into a new home near a school that was appropriate for them. I can no longer work outside my home, and I've had to drastically reduce my professional workload to manage the care of my children. I'm a residential designer, and I'm fortunate that I can work from my home, but I've had to reduce to my ability to expand my services to my clients. We will continue to do what we can and make sure Joe and Maggie are as healthy as they can be as they progress and eventually become unable to keep up with the devastating effects of MPS. It is impossible for me to express how hard these children fight for their health. Their ability to keep up this fight has given me the courage and the inspiration to try to seek improvements for all MPS children and for rare disease groups in general. The following points are relevant for the South Carolina Department of Disabilities, just to give you a little picture of what it is like where I live. They receive about $300 million in federal Medicaid funding to provide services. They currently serve 28,000 people. Approximately 82% of these people live at home with their families, compared to only 60% nationally. The report that I got this information from lists the following opportunities to increase the use of Medicaid funding to provide flexible in-home support for increased individual family independence and to strengthen technology capabilities and to enhance service provider productivity and efficiency. They also pointed out a few barriers, and mostly the barriers have to do with the long waiting lists. When my son was number 12 on the waiting list, that didn't seem so bad. I didn't know it would be 3 years later before he was at the top of the list. And then their other barrier is, again, the recruitment and the retention of nurses. So that it continues to be a big problem. We have a matrix of caregivers who come into our home. We don't have people all the time, but we have three nights a week covered, and we have an LPN during the day who goes to school with our kids to handle their meds and their feeds. It is encouraging to know that my state recognizes some of the same challenges that parents see, and it is my hope that South Carolina and other states will continue to look for solutions. It is also encouraging that Commissioner Estru is committed to improving the disability determination process for the disability insurance and supplemental security income programs. I think it's important to really stress the problem from a point of view of a parent. Many parents have expressed that the lack of knowledge about MPS is the biggest problem, specifically the degree and the rate of decline that these children face. Most parents eventually recognize that they must advocate for their child and that they must educate everyone involved with their child's care about the nature of MPS. The disorder is rare and it's hard to understand. It's hard to pronounce, it's hard to spell, and it's hard to remember unless you have a child with it. It is degenerative and it is impossible to predict how quickly decline will occur. Unfortunately, many parents are not emotionally ready to take on the role of advocate soon after diagnosis when they should be pursuing these approval processes. If MPS was on the compassionate allowance list, it would certainly lessen that burden on the parent. It would allow the state to start helping the family as early as possible, which would give the parent some time to acclimate to the important role of advocate. Early approval. It's important to recognize, too, that success depends on the approval of services prior to need. In our case, because we struggled so much with this diagnosis and this decline, we had some strong support. My physical therapist, for one, just insisted that I pursue getting an adaptive band with modifications to be able to transfer my children. My children were still basically walking with help at that point. But she continued to harass me to do this, and finally I did it. So that by the time my children were completely confined to their chairs, we had this important milestone marked off our list. Now we can safely transport our children to doctor's appointments and wherever they need to go. But our success was a result of an experienced professional who could predict our need and who went beyond the required scope of her job as a physical therapist to get me on board. Most parents are not that lucky. I was fortunate that I have people who were able to guide me through this. Another problem that MPS parents have experienced is a lack of technical training for service coordinators who must seek approvals for services. Parents state that the service coordinators and caseworkers are not adequately trained to file paperwork, and that will not be denied, or the approving agency is not trained to respond, so problems can be resolved quickly. Parents request that this type of delay in approval of services be addressed by providing relevant, regular technical training for everyone involved in the approval process. And then I think it's important to identify strong service coordinators. It's not practical for all service coordinators to be trained in the unique challenges of rare disorders. Identify and match strong service coordinators with families with rare diseases. Our service coordinator is a very vital part of our picture. She predicts our needs ahead of time. And most importantly, she writes letters and assists medical professionals with writing letters that get approved. I've had several other service coordinators who had different and more unsuccessful approaches. I had to learn to advocate for a service coordinator who could handle our situation. MPS parents and government agencies share the same goal: keep children at home while providing support that allows the family to continue to function. The parent and the service coordinator must develop a working relationship to plan ahead for the challenges of caring for these MPS children. The doctors and other health professionals must be open to writing descriptive letters that illustrate the disease process and allow the reviewer to understand the complex nature of MPS. The approving agencies must recognize that there's not a cookbook approach to approving the services needed to keep these children in their homes. Information describing the impact of the disorder would be helpful, but a change in the philosophy for handling a rare degenerative disorder like MPS will provide the greatest improvement. Thank you for taking time to learn about MPS and Joe and Maggie, and I appreciate the opportunity to share this with you and the fact that you value my views. I think this is an important step to improving the approval process.
Thank you very much. Let me kick off the first question. It'll be a long-winded one, and I apologize for that. And it's going to eventually loop around to the question, how can we do what we need to do quickly, consistent with doing it well? We have a number of constraints in this process. We have a statute that says we can only give disability for people that we believe are unable to work for 12 months or more. That's the shorthand for it. So for instance, one of the things that means for us is that for some degenerative diseases, at initial diagnosis, the person doesn't meet our standards, but we know with certainty that they will later on. And so we need to come up with standards and markers to try to draw that line in an appropriate way. And sometimes genetic information helps, but sometimes it makes it harder. You know, for instance, with Huntington's disease, used to be probably at the point that they were eventually diagnosed, those patients, you knew that they were disabled under our standards. Now they can be diagnosed at birth with genetic, and they may not have significant impairments until the time they're 40. So we have a statutory obligation to balance that out, to draw those kinds of lines, which makes the task of going through all 7,000 rare diseases to try to figure out what to say about them very difficult. And we've got now more options in terms of what we can say. We can do the traditional route and just simply put guidance into the listings. We can put something in the quick disability determination list and say it's highly probable but not certain, where we still go through our normal processes. We just move it up to the top of the queue and so they get decided very quickly. Or we can, in probably what will be a relatively limited number of cases, go to conclusive presumptions and call something a compassionate allowance. Operationally, this is an enormous task for us. I think if I remember correctly, David has about 150 people to do all the medical related work, and you start looking at the size of what they've already done in the past, asking them to do a lot more, you could easily see how that could bog down and get slow. So we've been doing some talking about how do we go about, just from an operational point of view, doing this well and quickly. You know, we've talked about perhaps hiring contractors to assist us to go through this list, and it might be helpful to know what types of organizations might be able to do this work, have the adequate medical knowledge, but also apply our statutory standard to it to make sure that we get what we need, the right end result at the end. We've reached out, obviously, to NIH and to NORD and lots of other organizations, but I think that task probably isn't finished yet, and we probably haven't talked to all the organizations that might have information that could help us do this well and quickly, and then when we've gone through the first time through, to update on a regular basis. So I just thought I'd throw it open for initial question to see if you have any advice or guide. If you were in our shoes, or more accurately, in David's shoes, since he's on the front line on this, how would you think about this? How would you organize the task? Because, you know, you spend a lot of time looking at one disease, it all becomes very obvious. But if you look at a relatively small organization that's trying to look at a ton of these, how do you do that efficiently and well? Any suggestions or guidance?
Oh, first of all, I mean, you've made a really good start. I mean, you're out there reaching out to Steve Groff's office at the NIH, to NORD, to both the patient organizations, American Academy of Pediatrics. So I think you've made a really important first step. And I think possibly identify maybe, I hate using this phrase, but the low-lying fruit, so to speak, and turning to experts, NORD's Medical Advisory Committee, the medical advisory committees of other organizations working in conjunction with Steve Groff's office. I think that is probably one of the most important things that you've done so far. I don't have the answers to the really bigger questions, but I think you've made a really important step forward.
It's an enormous task when you talk about 7,000 diseases. And many of them, there may be only a handful of people in the country who really have expertise in that particular disease. It seems to me as if some sort of consultative panel of experts would be useful in terms of convening to consider the 7,000 disorders in one way or another. People with specialized expertise, not necessarily on one particular disorder, but on these classes of problems. And of course, not only the medical expertise that may be necessary, but people with the personal and the social experience to go through that as well. But I think some sort of a panel is probably going to be imperative who can provide you with some sort of report that you could work from.
I would like to say maybe, Steve, it's time to bring together the panel and kind of relook at that report that was issued by the commission back in 1989. I know that's a big task, but I think that would probably be, since the model is already available and worked, that would probably be the most viable opportunity for that suggestion.
I think that's part of our involvement here is really to look at what is available, the resources that are available, especially in the medical profession, the specialty societies that will be necessary to make those judgments. And I think it's important to understand, too, that many of the patient advocacy groups have outstanding medical and scientific advisory boards that we shouldn't overlook. And Sissy, if I could just ask a question, too,
sure.
The willingness of your medical advisory board to participate in such an activity of maybe saying, when does disability really start to occur? Is there a level that we can say is a drop-off point for the patients that we really need to be concerned about? Have you discussed this with your board?
I have. Unfortunately, because of the way the diseases appear, it varies greatly. You know, even within our family, it would have been hard for a pediatrician to know that both these kids had the same disease. It took a long time, and we just started sensing that Maggie had what Joe had. I think the one positive thing, though, about the way our medical advisory boards work is in the rare diseases, chances are the doctors on our board are also on some other boards, the Batten disease and some other related lysosomal storage diseases. So that the community grows as the researchers do research on different diseases and work with those organizations. So some of these researchers have a very good understanding of many of the of a type of disease, so they can offer that. But again, I mean, anytime we even ask our scientific, my geneticist, who's of course on our board, I ask them questions about things that are happening with my children, and they're not sure if that's related, or if it's, they're not, it's just impossible to predict the outcome of the disease.
I think we're asking the administration and whatever panel were to be put together to, of course, to play the role of King Solomon in some way and make the difficult choices. On the other hand, I think there are certain conditions that are clearly more devastating than others and really probably do need to rise to the top and do need to be considered first in within the system. So while we're talking about 7,000, there is going to be a core that is absolutely devastating and heartbreaking in many ways and that are probably not going to be quite as difficult to make decisions about.
You got to get very close to the microphone, or we're going to end up talking to someone we can't see again.
Dr. Lipkin, one of the interesting observations that Ms. Langford made was the fact that the doctors did not know how to present the information to the disability process. They're thinking as physicians; they're thinking in terms of treating the patient. They're not thinking in terms of translating that into the information that the examiner needs. Do you have any suggestions on how the physicians that treat these rare diseases might be given information that would help them to provide more useful information to the disability process?
Yeah, well, certainly the physician is confronted with forms that can be sometimes lengthy, obtuse, and not in a language that he or she is familiar with in terms of thinking. Certainly has not been trained to complete. The specialists who are dealing with some of these disorders have had more of a routine of being asked for such information, but nevertheless, I think often will rely upon administrative staff and support people to do that. I think there probably does need to be consideration for some core information, particularly when talking about rare disorders, and some key questions that are in common medical language and medical terminology that will be important. I think at the same time, I think in medicine we are moving more and more towards this concept of functional skills, functional impairments. Quite frankly, I think most physicians, including pediatricians, that's still a foreign concept. Hopefully newer people coming to the field of medicine will better understand them. But I think that is a language that both the medical field and Social Security needs to adapt, because I think it's completely intended for these purposes. And so there probably needs to be a joint educational process in any inquiries that are requested from Social Security office probably needs to use those new approaches.
I also feel it would be beneficial if the doctors would take advantage of the support groups, because we certainly provide a lot of literature and we can connect doctors with researchers who are familiar and who actually, like in England, where clinicians who see San Filippo children their whole lives because of the way their government health works there. So there is a lot of information available that's at that doctor level, and I think it as a parent, it's my responsibility to encourage my doctor to seek that out. It's hard. It can be a hard sell to get the doctors to want to do that, and I recognize that they have, you know, they have a lot to do, but there needs to be some way to get them, you know, used to reaching out to the family support groups. We've tried to go to the doctor, large meeting conferences and stuff, and there's such an overload of information there. It's probably not beneficial to hand out our brochures at, you know, American Academy of Pediatrics. Right.
Ms. Langford points out some important issues in terms of information gaps that physicians will have. I think it probably is worthwhile highlighting here that in nearly every state and union, there are federally funded USEDs or university centers that are intended to provide assistance for families in both medically and therapeutically. Quite frankly, I think a few physicians even know about the existence of such facilities, and I think they are probably going to be important key players in assisting this process as well.
And it's just not the responsibility of the Social Security Administration. It's the entire rare disease community working interactively with one another. I was looking at this particular rare disease, which I'm going to try to pronounce. I'm going to break it down. Lymphangioleiomyomatosis. So if I were a doctor or if I were a reviewer at the Social Security Administration and I saw that, I would have no clue whatsoever about what to do about that particular rare disease. So I think it's communicating, reaching out, and all working with one another, because although the community in the aggregate is very large, in essence it's very, very small, and we need to be reaching out to one another more.
It's an outstanding point. Let me just talk to that briefly, and I want to make sure I give Frank a chance too. I don't want to hog the forum. But one of the ways to conceptualize the problem that we have here is it's just a lack of information. And one of the things I think it's important to understand is how the process works is by statute, the states make the first two levels of decision making for us. And we have representatives, I know, from the National Association of Disability Examiners here, and it would be a good idea in the break, for instance, to corner some of them and talk to them about what they do and how they do it. And I've talked to a lot of these folks. They're very low paid compared to federal standards. The turnover is very high. In many states, the average experience of an examiner is about 3 years. And of course, medical school takes four. And these tend to be, almost without exception, terrific people. They self-select because they want to help. And they often have a social work degree, a psychology degree. They're terrific people. But you look at the vast array of things here. They get very good very quickly at the cases they see all the time. And then they turn to experts, and they have in-house experts, medical experts, for the diseases that they don't recognize. But there the problem is one where, again, we don't have rare disease experts. It would be impractical to do that actually working within the DDSs. And I think what typically happens is that a generalist dusts off his medical textbooks, and there isn't very much there either. I remember there was a stunning case. I remember talking to the head of the MPS Society for Europe, and I think it was mucopolysaccharidosis too. Hunter disease, and and I may have that wrong, I may have the disease wrong, but a mom applied for disability for the child, and they have a similar system in the UK, and the doc went to the textbook, and the disease wasn't there. And so he essentially, the local disability arm actually started prosecuting the family for fraud. You know, and said the disease didn't exist, or the symptoms didn't exist, and that type of thing. So it's important. While it's very natural when you're frustrated to assume that there have got to be badly motivated people in the process. Almost without exception, that's not the case. These are absolutely terrific people who work in very difficult circumstances. And it is, a lot of the problems aren't their fault, they're our fault, because we need to make it easier when they see a disease that they haven't seen before to click on their increasingly sophisticated computers and punch in Marfan's or punch in Sanfilippo and have some form of guidance, and whether it's in the listings, whether it's QDD or what it is, I think that's really what we need to do. And it's important not just for the examiners, but it's important because the physicians often have those gaps too, and it's because the textbooks and a lot of the standard things that they look for tend to overlook the rare diseases. So I think the way to conceptualize this a lot of the times is, how do we get the right information easily to the people that make the decisions? And to the extent you can help us with that, because a lot of these diseases, again, it's going to be, we can't put by statute everybody in, and we're going to have to figure out how to draw lines. And to the extent that particularly the physicians that work in your areas can help us draw those lines intelligently and consistent with the statute, that's going to help us move along this project much, much faster if we can do that.
My mother gave me some really good advice as I was growing up. She said, you don't have to know everything, just hang around with really smart people. Yeah. And so I think that's really important, a very good lesson that we all have to abide by is working with one another.
Well, as an English major in biotech, I learned that pretty darn fast. Frank, do you have some questions?
I would like to follow up with the point that the commissioner just made and that David asked about. Certainly, the information that the medical sources provide to us is obviously critical. And if you have any further thoughts on how we can encourage or make that process easier so we get the information we need earlier, certainly would be very helpful. But it also goes to the families and the other people familiar with the particular situation. So if you have any thoughts on how we can approach perhaps encouraging more of that information to be provided earlier in the process. As I pointed out, I'm an administrative law judge. Many of the cases we see, we end up finding out that there's some additional evidence that was not provided earlier. So if you have any other thoughts on how we could improve that process, I certainly would like to hear that.
Well, I think you both nicely highlighted the importance of all the information that's now available online. And so not only is that available to the people making disability determination, but to the pediatrician who's never heard of X, Y, or Z disease and whose textbook doesn't have it, or to the parent as well. And actually the NIH has done a great job with making information like that available. CDC has done that as well, and I think those are excellent vehicles that all communities really take advantage of, and I think is probably going to be critical information in this whole process.
One thing maybe to think about, I know at the risk we're moving this into more informal dialogue than formal question and answer, but that's okay as far as I'm concerned. One of the things that if you're with a disease association you might think about doing is, I know a lot of times the websites have a lot of very helpful information, often about how to apply for Medicare and you know where to find free drugs, and they're terrific resource for the patients. One of the things you may think about is helping yourselves to help us to the extent that you can come up with explanations of what our process requires, and in particular what you need to tell us in terms of functionality that's important for the particular disease. That might be very helpful to patients if we do have to make an ad hoc decision. The other thing, and this is a very practical thing, and it's a great frustration for a lot of the people who are in the system. One of the big reasons we make a lot of incorrect decisions is that we just don't have the full medical record. And so one of the things that's really important to stress to your members is to get the complete medical record in as early in the process as possible. A lot of times we actually don't see the full medical record until the case has already been kicking around for a couple of years. And that's bad for you, that's bad for us, that's bad for everybody. So, mostly, we're trying to figure out how to do our own work better, but you may be also, many of you in the audience and many of you listening to this in remote locations, you may also be able to help your own members to work for us if they know kind of what our requirements are for applying for disability and what things we need to look at in terms of functionality. And I think that might be helpful to a lot of the people going through the process that perhaps aren't going to benefit from a compassionate allowance because it's one of those diseases where we do have to make an ad hoc decision. But knowing more about our rules and what we need and what we need to look at might help people get through the process more quickly and with better results.
certainly any fast-track system needs to be made available online, and certainly would expedite families' ability to apply, but also for the physicians as well to provide that key information. You know, particularly if you're talking about getting medical hard copies of medical records from hospitals, you know, it could take months. And we're more moving towards electronic record systems as well, and pediatricians and family physicians in our offices are going to start having that more. And I think we need to have a system for such expedited review that can really make that information available very quickly.
That's a terrific point that I actually didn't anticipate coming up today, but we are working on. It's going to take us a while. Our system for online application is not as quick, and it's true for retirement as well as disability, and we have an ongoing effort to try to streamline those, make them user-friendly. That's a pretty big effort in our world, and we're also wrestling with how to plug in medical records because the system is in transition, and so, you know, I guess about a third of all Americans now have pretty complete electronic records. So we're trying to figure out how to adapt our system so that we can take full advantage of that going forward. We're not there yet, but you're exactly right. We need to do that well in order to do this quickly. Any other questions?
Doctor, there's been a lot of discussion here about function, and we've obviously been asking questions about how we can improve the process of getting information as early as possible in the process. One of the discussions that I've thought some about is when we ask physicians or medical sources for information about function, many times we're asking the medical sources, doctor, what can this person do despite their impairments? And I've had some conversations with some medical sources where they suggest that maybe a better approach would be to ask something like, well, you know, as a result of this impairment, what is it the person cannot do? What are the limitations imposed by the impairment? Do physicians look at that differently, asking them what a person can do versus what a person cannot do?
Absolutely. And particularly when you're whether you're talking about children or adults, I think it is much easier information to glean. And in fact, when the new classification system for function, International Classification of Function, ICF, that was put together internationally, they rely a lot upon descriptions of children in multiple different scenarios, adults as well, in multiple different scenarios, exactly how they handle being on the street, how they handle being in a supermarket, how they handle even mountain climbing, interestingly enough. Absolutely, I think while we've always functioned on disability and impairment, the ability is really what we want to tap into realistically. What is a person able to do rather than unable to do?
But the question really goes to what is easier for the physician to answer? Is it an easier question to answer what the person can do versus what they can't do, or vice versa?
Yeah, I think, well, the physician, whether it be interviewing the patient themselves or the parent, can certainly knows how to ask and can ask well as to where that person goes every day and what they do. And rather than thinking about all the things they don't do, it's very easy for a family member to explain what a person does do and what their daily life is like.
I'd like to add that I think it's relevant to say what can't be done in order to emphasize the need for the services. The example is our children needed aides in school, one-on-one aides, because at a particular point in San Filippo, the children are extremely hyper, and they were damaging other kids, and they were in a disability class, and we had to write letters to get aides assigned to Joe and Maggie based on what they can't do, which is, you know, behave in class or whatever. And so I think if as far as getting approval process is going, I think it makes sense to state in an everyday situation what the child can't do.
If I could just add that
it would be important for us to hear of the data elements or the criteria that would be necessary that you'd like to receive so that perhaps we need to repackage the information that is available to the public. I think if one looks at what is made available through the patient advocacy groups, through the NIH, through NORD, other organizations, that there's considerable information available, but it's how we package it, does it really make sense for a reviewer or someone to look at it, and perhaps you could help us identify what is actually needed to facilitate your decision making down at the local level. So that would be helpful. And I know the discussions have been held with the Library of Medicine, that the folks seem to be very willing to work with the Social Security Administration to provide whatever we can do to assist.
Yeah, no, I know. It's just been absolutely spectacular so far, and we're very grateful. Okay. I think despite our technological glitches, we're off to a great start. So I want to thank the witnesses. This has been tremendously helpful. We're grateful for your input. And we're actually pretty much on time, and I think I can give you a decent break. So why don't we take half an hour and come back at 11:10, and then we'll move to our next panel. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner.
So we have another three-person panel, very distinguished panel. We have Linda Landry, who's a senior attorney from the Disability Law Center in Boston. We have William Leach, who's a staff attorney for the Access Program in Tampa, as well as Kim Bernstein, who's director of the Access Program in Tampa. Thank you very much for joining us today. Whichever way you want to go. Yeah, and I hate to be repetitive, and people have had to remind me, too, that because of our technological limitations in the room, speak as close to the microphone as you can. I realize it's a little uncomfortable, and I apologize, but that's the way to make sure everybody hears what you have to say.
Thank you very much. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. As you said, my name is Linda Landry. I'm a senior attorney at the Disability Law Center. I've been representing people before the Social Security Administration for about 27 years. And it's my opinion that the problems with disability determinations for people with rare conditions and diseases are pretty much the same as the problems with the process for everybody else. It's perhaps more acute with people with rare conditions and diseases where they're even less well known than other conditions. But I think the problem starts right at the very beginning with the application. Not enough of the right kind of information is identified, is requested of applicants when they apply. It's very medical, doctor, hospital specific. And when you're talking about a lot of the disability adjudications that are needed, you also need other sources of information that supply that critical functional capacity, ability to function on a day-to-day basis information. Often the doctors don't really have that, spend enough time with the individual who's applying, and it is other resources out there, other non-doctor professional medical resources, other non-medical professional sources. If you're talking about children, it's school information, counselors, and therapists. And those sources tend not to be identified unless the advocate, the applicant, has been sort of coached to provide that information. It's not really sought on the application. And I also think that when sources are requested to provide information from Social Security, they're really not asked specifically enough for what Social Security needs. In Massachusetts, we work pretty closely with our DDS, which I think overall does a really great job, and I agree with you entirely, Commissioner, that they're underpaid and overworked. But they have forms for some conditions and diseases, but certainly not all of them, and some of them are out of date, and we've been talking about trying to update them, but the time and the money doesn't seem to be available to do that. I don't think doctors and other sources of information really understand the disability determination, the disability definition for adults or children. And they don't really know how to respond. And when an advocate gets involved, that's a lot of what an advocate does, is, you know, try to send them information that they'll read and are able to digest about what the disability standard is and what Social Security really needs to determine whether somebody, A, has a medically determinable impairment, and B, what the nature and severity of that impairment is, and whether it actually means that an adult is unable to work for 12 months, or a child has marked and severe limitations such that they should be considered eligible under the childhood disability standard. You know, the other thing that happens in evaluating information from a lot of these sources is, you know, you're getting the information, especially the readily prepared information, the already prepared information in the ordinary course, that is, they're talking to each other. They use terms and phrases that they know what it means, but it doesn't necessarily correlate into the language of the disability standard. And sometimes it's like two foreign languages colliding. You know, often I will see a person denied because in the medical notes it says the individual is doing well, but it often means well under the circumstances. It doesn't mean they're better. It doesn't even necessarily mean they can function well enough to work or to function as a child without a disability would function. You know, so there are those kinds of language problems. When you're talking about children's disability, you also run into these language problems with school records. School records are incredibly important for the disability determination for a child, yet you know, you've got to speak special education. You've got to speak education in order to understand what happens. I had an example of this in my own case, a case for a child where the child was being mainstreamed into one class. Previously to this, the child had been in a substantially separate class, small classroom with a lot of assistance, and he was being mainstreamed. And the adjudicator was incredibly interested in this, thinking it meant that the child was probably no longer disabled, although the adjudicator agreed that the child had been disabled before. I don't speak special education either, so I went back to the teacher, and she said, "Let me be clear. He's mainstreamed in science. He has a one-to-one aide. The aide tells him what's going to happen before he goes into the classroom. He goes into the classroom with the aide. And then she goes out, she takes him out of the classroom and tells him what happened." So he's, you know, he was mainstreamed, but not really in the sense of a same-age child without a disability. So that's just one example of these kinds of language problems that we bump into in these cases. Also, functional capacity isn't really sought, especially not early on. In my experience, medical information is sought. But treating sources and other professional sources really not asked to provide functional information. What can the individual do on a sustained basis, day in and day out? What can the child do or not do that same-age children without disabilities are expected to do? That information is not always sought. And that's another thing that advocates do when they get a case, actively seek that out. Another problem that you really don't have any control over, unfortunately, is the difficulty of getting medical information out of sources, or information from any sources, really. A prior panel member said that it can take months to get hospital records, and that's really true. Hospitals are, you know, trying desperately to keep nurses on the floor, and they do not lushly staff the medical records department. Plus, you've got this overlay of HIPAA. I call it HIPAA hysteria. where, you know, scrutiny of your medical release is common. You know, there's a lot of turnover in these jobs, so you get the partially trained person who's afraid her hospital will be sued if she lets you have these documents because it doesn't look quite right to him or her. So there's just a lot of difficulty in getting medical information, especially from specialists. It's particularly difficult. Often the medical evidence that is kept in the ordinary course for the providers Doesn't really answer your questions, the questions you need to know, the questions I need to know to evaluate a case and decide whether to even take it. And I have to go back to them for more information. And often it takes a very long time to get the definitive piece of evidence and present it. And sometimes that comes rather late in the process, which is too bad for the claimant. I know that most of the DDSs have medical relations staff, and they do spend as much time as they can to be out there with medical providers and tell them about the importance of responding to the requests and doing it timely. I think there's also some financial rewards if you do it timely, but apparently it's not enough to get them all to respond on time. I think medical expertise is often lacking to your adjudicators in the disability determination process. You know, there's in-house doctors at the DDSs. There are consultative examinations. People are contracted to provide these. And then there are medical experts at hearings. And it's my understanding that the reimbursement available to attract these people probably isn't sufficient to get enough or to get all of the right expertise. You know, we've seen a lot of problems at the earlier levels, especially with children, some of the rare conditions that other panelists have talked about. People haven't heard of them. The pediatrician doesn't know enough to provide the information that Social Security needs. And, you know, the in-house doctors aren't aware of it. I've seen children with, you know, really severe metabolic disorders, you know, get denied when it was fairly obvious that they should have been allowed if the right information had been provided to the DDS examiner. Often the DDS examiner has wanted to allow, but felt that, you know, they didn't have the medical expertise necessary. You know, and I've seen these problems over the years with all kinds of conditions, which are now maybe not considered so rare. When I first started doing this 27 years ago, lupus was a problem. People hadn't heard of lupus, and I had to drag in people from the Lupus Society to my hearings to explain what lupus was and that my client's symptoms and limits were typical of people with that kind of a condition. And I've seen it with chronic fatigue, with HIV and AIDS, with reflex sympathetic dystrophy, and lots of others. Sometimes disability evaluation rules that are helpful to the case are not followed. You know, how you weigh different medical opinions are specifically laid out in the rules. The evaluation of pain and other subjective symptoms is one that's frequently misapplied. And the evaluation of mental impairments of all types of severity, really. The last time the mental impairment listings were improved, adjusted, they were really improved, especially the information in the preface where there are some explanation about how Social Security looks at mental impairment disabilities and the kinds of tests that are available. That prefatory information is really, really very helpful. It's helpful to me as an advocate. Sometimes I wish others would read it in more depth. I also wanted to note that some of the Social Security rulings that have been issued in the last few years have been very helpful. There have been a number of rulings issued on conditions that have been difficult to adjudicate. Chronic fatigue syndrome is one, interstitial cystitis is another, post-polio syndrome and reflex sympathetic dystrophy. These rulings are really very helpful, in part because they explain the condition, they talk about what you need to make a diagnosis, and then what you need to determine the functional impact. And now it might be impractical to come up with a ruling for every rare condition, but perhaps a roadmap could be laid out that would help guide adjudicators generally for rare conditions, how you get the information and then what you do with it. One of the big problems that you run into in cases is what you need to determine that the person in fact has a diagnosis or a medically determinable impairment, and then what you can use to evaluate the functional impact of that. It's very different, and often those rules aren't correctly done. Existing expediting processes are important. I think there's been some confusion about when what can be used. I think the QDD has worked wonderfully in Massachusetts. It's really great. We happy to see that expanded. I know our DDS examiners like it because they really feel like they can get benefits to people who really need them very quickly. On the other side, it's important to make sure that payment is also expedited. Sometimes that doesn't happen. But I think there's been some confusion about whether QDD has supplanted other kinds of expediting, like the TERRY process for terminal illness and presumptive disability, which is useful for people who are eligible for it because they can get benefits while Social Security dots all the I's and crosses all the T's for a formal determination. They can get benefits more quickly. That's only available in initial SSI determinations, but that is something that people can really benefit from. So I think that it's important to make sure all evidence is collected from all sources that have something to say about the impact of a medically determinable impairment on someone's condition, to make sure that applicants have help filing the paperwork. Many can't do this on their own and don't do a very good job of completing the information without help. Make sure applicants know what is needed to determine disability under the standard. Try to provide more information to doctors, perhaps working through some of these, especially the rare disease groups that are here today, to make sure they understand the standard and what they need to provide. Collect functional capacity information much earlier. Improve medical expertise in all areas of the system. And perhaps consider providing more guidance to your adjudicators in some of the important roles and how to evaluate, especially rare cases. I find that particularly in childhood disability cases, not all adjudicators are familiar with the standard and the evaluation rules. It's a relatively new standard. It's changed a few times over the years. And I think it's difficult to understand what the evaluation for a child is. I think most of us can understand trying to figure out what might prevent an adult from working, but it's hard to think about, you know, when a child has a marked and severe functional limit below what you would expect of the same age child without a disability. It's just more conceptually difficult. And I would recommend, as I said, providing more guidance through Social Security rulings. They've been very helpful over the years. And make sure that that current expediting processes are clarified and people know how to use them. I think it would be useful to expand the listings. It's always been my opinion that if something isn't in the listings, there's sometimes a bit of a sense that it isn't as important or not as likely to be disabling. And certainly having more access to information about specific rare conditions and diseases would be very helpful to Social Security adjudicators. Although I think you have to take care. Anytime you come up with a list, somebody's going to take it as the definitive list. So it's important that as you expand lists or create new ones to make sure that all adjudicators understand that it's not all-inclusive and that it's not intended to denigrate any other conditions that aren't on the list. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to continue the policy of holding off our questions at the end, although I do want to add one other process point because your testimony reminded me, you veered close a couple times to subjects where we have ongoing, we're taking comment on ongoing rulemaking, which is fine, but I just wanted to make sure that you and other witnesses know it's okay for us to actually talk about this, but we have a memo that we follow from the totally unreasonable General Counsel of HHS in 1991 that says we have to put those on the record. If when we go into the Q&A, I don't want to inhibit any conversation, but I feel honor-bound to let you and others know that if we actually do cross over the line and something that we're taking comment on now, our lawyers will have to sort of summarize that and put that in the official administrative record. So I just wanted to...
Don't want to make more work for the lawyers.
Yeah, I try to make it as easy for them as possible. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We'll move on now to Mr. Leach.
Morning. My name is Bill Leach with the Access Program in Tampa, Florida. I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk to you today about issues of disability and determinations for people with rare diseases. Excuse me. Since 1995, I have represented hundreds of claimants with rare chronic conditions before the Social Security Administration. Our program provides representation at no cost to these individuals as that are part of certain specific disease communities. My comments and suggestions are based on this experience and are focused primarily on the disorders in which our program specializes. I should emphasize that both Kim Bernstein and I are speaking here today on, in our capacity as advocates for the disabled and not on behalf of the company that funds our program. I would begin by talking a little bit about the Terry cases. My experience with those is that they generally don't need me. If it's a Terry case, I can pretty much tell them what they need to do and have them get in touch with the local office, and I don't hear from them because basically that's a success story. So, you know, the Terry process where it's working is working well. Most of my clients don't qualify for Terry or for some of the other like presumptive disability cases. And so that's mainly what I'm going to be talking about today. It's not that I don't get those cases, it's just that I have very little interaction with those clients because for the most part they get what they're looking for. In my experience, people with rare diseases who unquestionably qualify under the listing of impairments can have widely divergent outcomes. One of the things that I often tell our clients is that I can take the same facts and put them in front of two different adjudicators and get two different results. Some claims are approved quickly, some take longer than anticipated, and there's really no reliable way to predict how long a given claim is going to take. Moreover, the lack of predictability in the actual outcomes leads to a perception in the general population that the process isn't always fair. Part of the disparity arises from the fact that some of the listings are open to interpretation. There's one that's in the process of being revised, and I should probably be careful about talking about this based on what we just said. But there's one for what's referred to in the adult listings as cell-mediated immune deficiency, which talks about documented recurrent severe infections, and there is an ongoing process to revise that into something a little more specific. The problem is that there's never been a definition of severe. And so in hearings, we often get into a question of what is or isn't a severe infection for somebody that has no immune system. This is something that reasonable minds can differ on, and so this is one of the reasons why we get disparate outcomes, is that the listings themselves are often largely open to interpretation where there's a lot of terms used that aren't really defined. And again, the process of going through the listings and trying to sharpen those and clarify those I think will help to minimize some of those issues as we go forward. One of the problems I've been hearing a lot about lately is determining which listing has been met and at what time. We've talked a little bit about amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. I've had a few calls recently from people who were approved for disability for a diagnosis other than ALS and then were subsequently diagnosed. And this is not uncommon. People with ALS have severe health problems long before they're actually finally diagnosed. The problem is that they're being told now that they have to go through the 24-month waiting period for Medicare because they were not originally diagnosed with ALS as part of the determination for their disability. Since we're talking about compassionate allowances, one of the things that I would like to suggest we maybe think about is using that as a process to amend favorable determinations to include a diagnosis where we can medically relate it back, showing that the ALS was in existence at the time the determination was made. Right now, there's no good way to do that. We're sort of doing it on a catch-as-catch-can basis. This would allow people with ALS to get into the Medicare system sooner than the 24 months that it is typically required. That's because typically they don't survive 24 months. Typically, by the time they qualify under the old law, the Medicare card came too late for them. In some instances, the delays in allowing claims for people with rare chronic conditions arises from what's been referred to as the translation problem. I've also often talked about it as basically a translating from one language to another, basically from medical to regulatory. Part of the problem, you know, we've talked about the fact that Social Security doesn't speak in medical terms, and certainly that's at least one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that doctors don't understand the disability process. And I think that Social Security can maybe do a little bit more about reaching out to them and getting them to understand the process that Social Security actually uses to determine things. It's a sort of an interesting puzzle where at the one end I've got a DDS adjudicator who's trying to read handwritten progress notes from the doctor, trying to figure out what the doctor is talking about. And at the other end, the doctor is scratching his head looking at an RFC form saying, how do I fit my patient into this form? So I think that there needs to be more of an outreach and cross-communication between the medical community and the Social Security Administration to talk about these functional limitations that we've been discussing all day, because that's one of the biggest issues in terms of not only getting the medical evidence in a timely fashion, but getting it in a form that Social Security can use it. And I also want to tag on to what's been said earlier about the folks at the DDS. These folks are doing the best job they can with what they got to work with. Anything that we can do to make it easier for them, I'm all in favor of. And I think part of that would be to help them understand that there are conditions out there that they're only going to see once or twice in their entire career, as opposed to the bad backs that they see every day. And that there needs to be special resources available to help them adjudicate those types of cases. One of the examples that I give in my written testimony about this problem of translating, there's a listing for what I refer to as pulmonary hypertension. It's listing 3.09A. The listing actually calls it core pulmonal secondary to pulmonary vascular hypertension. A lot of people that meet this listing get turned down, and the reason why, I think, is because a lot of these buzzwords do not appear in medical records. I rarely see core pulmonal showing up in pulmonary hypertension medical records. And it's interesting because in the explanatory material that's in the front of that section actually talks about the term that's more commonly used, which is right ventricular hypertrophy. But it's not in the listing. And the other problem is that the condition, as I said, is typically referred to as pulmonary hypertension, not pulmonary vascular hypertension. One of my suggestions is that if we could create a database where adjudicators had access to the ICD-9 codes that are used for insurance purposes, medical purposes, to identify medical conditions, this would help them to identify cases where it requires special consideration, where there's a particular listing that they may not be aware of, that would allow them to quickly and easily pull up perhaps a specific questionnaire designed by medical professionals familiar with that particular condition that can then be sent to the treating physician, so that when we request the medical records, we not only get the medical records back, but we also get a questionnaire that does fit the patient when the doctor looks at it. And that's something that I think can be implemented simply by requiring that we move from the FUSL codes to the ICD-9 codes, so that we've got a consistent system for identifying these different disease states. Taking pulmonary hypertension as an example, the questionnaire could be used to identify claimants who use medications that require a continuous infusion pump through an implanted catheter, which is a common therapy for that particular condition, or they require frequent daily use of a very specialized inhalation device that, again, has a lot of different requirements, or meet some of the other criteria that we're looking for under Terrier and so forth, such as a need for oxygen to function, suffer from chronic pulmonary or heart failure, or have been placed on a heart-lung transplant list. If we had some way of quickly and easily identifying these cases, it would make it easier for adjudicators to know, okay, there's a special process for claims with these types of facts in them. Finally, one of the problems, and I hesitate to say this, but I really don't know any other way to say it, there are some listings that the adjudicators just don't like. The listing that I have the most problem with is for children with inherited coagulation disorders, hemophilia, von Willebrand's disease. So it's listing 107.08A, and it's fairly simple. It provides for disability where there is repeated inappropriate or spontaneous bleeding, and that's all it says. I just represented a child in New York where the medical expert testifying at the hearing said that she didn't meet the listing, the child in question, despite the fact that she admitted my client had repeated bleeding episodes, but she hadn't been hospitalized recently. And I said, well, doctor, there's nothing in the listing that says that, and she says, I know, but she doesn't meet the listing. So some of the listings are just not favored. And other than telling people we really mean what this says, I don't know what else can be done about that problem. One of the issues specifically with people with coagulation defects, both adults and children, is that they frequently treat at home rather than a hospital or clinical setting. Treating physicians routinely rely on these home treatment records to prescribe for their patients. Allowing adjudicators to rely on home treatment records is just as the informed medical professionals do, would help expedite favorable outcomes for people who are often approved on appeal. In denying a claim, adjudicators often talk about the fact that the claimant is undergoing some form of treatment that lessens the impact of their disease. However, they hardly ever address the extent to which the relief is provided by this therapy. Very often, the treatment takes a horribly debilitating condition that makes it slightly less horrible, it's by no means a cure. And their benefits are usually offset to some degree by the impact of the therapy itself. What I would suggest is that things like the frequency, duration, and side effects of these treatments are rarely considered in the evaluation of a claimant's functional capacity until typically we get to the ALJ level in the hearing process. As an example, it's very difficult to maintain regular work attendance when you're going to require a six-hour infusion every 3 weeks for the rest of your life, and the treatment leaves you feeling ill for a day or so. This is a common pattern for, again, people with primary immune deficiency who are using intravenous immunoglobulin to treat their condition. Another group with a similar pattern of infusion is people with a genetic form of emphysema called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. The other thing that we often don't talk about in terms of functional limitations in treatment is how long does it take for the treatment to work? People with coagulation defects can suffer from extreme pain and restricted range of motion in the affected area for days before a bleeding episode is finally controlled. The sporadic and unpredictable occurrence of such episodes has a huge impact on their ability to function. These people with bleeding disorders, such as hemophilia and von Willebrand's disease, should be considered for compassionate allowance when the records demonstrate spontaneous bleeding episodes that require treatment, I'm going to suggest six times or more a year, because the functional impact of that is such that they would not be able to maintain regular employment or to maintain age-appropriate functioning in the case of children. I do think that the Social Security Administration needs to continue working with medical professionals who specialize in rare disorders to improve the listings. Again, I'm talking about hemophilia, which is probably about half of what I do. Adult listing 7.08 for coagulation defects looks for transfusions of whole blood, despite the fact that the prevailing treatment for this condition today consists of infusions of blood clotting factor. As a result, the listing is rarely met on terms of the language that's now being used. From a process standpoint, my feeling is that the pre-effectuation review by the regional offices of half of all SSDI allowances discourages complete claim development, particularly since the odds of having a denial reviewed are slight. I question the value of these reviews, and I would recommend substantially reducing, if not eliminating, them outright. On the flip side, we all know that it costs more to approve a claim after an appeal to ODAR than to approve it on an initial application, but that added cost is not borne by the responsible DDS. There needs to be some sort of disincentive that makes the denial of claims that are eventually paid as dreaded as the pre-effectuation review. This ought to include some sort of feedback to the adjudicator that denied the subsequently approved claim. I also want to give credit where credit is due. Many of the initiatives that the Social Security Administration has undertaken as part of the Disability Service Improvement Plan should help speed up the process. I do sometimes have some concerns about that because a quick decision is not always a good decision. I just talked with a client the other day about the fact that she was wanting them to hurry up and get her reconsideration done, and I said, listen, we're better off getting a good reconsideration now than waiting 2 years to get a favorable decision from the ALJ. So speed is good, but we also still want process, you know, a quality process to take place as part of the review. The big problem that I think has been alluded to has been the lack of adequate funding for the Social Security Administration and for the DDSs. The hearing capacity is woefully inadequate for the number of claims that are pending for hearing. We've now got cases waiting for hearing 2 years and longer in many parts of the country. I realize that this is a legislative problem rather than a regulatory one, but it's probably the number one reason why so many people are waiting too long to be paid benefits that they're actually entitled to. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you.
My name is Kim Bernstein, and I would also like to thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'd also like to thank you for all the hard work you're doing. I originally became involved by listening to a presentation that Ms. Bronstein did at the NORD conference. I am the director of a program and have been for the past 13 years. Our program represents people, as Bill said, regardless of choice of provider and free of charge. Unlike Bill, I stopped doing hearings quite some time ago. I always say I'm in the recovery from the practice of law. Instead, I do the advocacy work, and I've been speaking around the country basically every other weekend for the last 13 years for many, many groups of people who need disability benefits. I think that we've spoken a bit about the convergence of translating medical information and regulatory information in order to get benefits, but the third thing I think we're missing is the language of denial, because what we find so often is that with these conditions, it really isn't a matter of is somebody faking it, although they may feel that. It's a matter of, have they met the level of severity? Do they have the medical records? And when they get to the hearing, are they a credible historian of their condition? My biggest concern is in the psychology of denial, we have people with can't-do bodies who have can-do attitudes, and it takes an awfully long time just to get to the point that they say that they're disabled or that they can say it at a hearing. I actually had somebody at a hearing who is a quarry worker with cystic fibrosis who, when asked, said, yeah, I could probably work. His pulmonary function studies showed he probably couldn't. But that's one of the problems that we have coming in, is that people who almost can't say I'm disabled, because disabled brings up broken, dead, half-dead, or inability to have a good day. I also find a lot of mothers, and I do think, just like the words for snow in the Eskimo language, there should be a different word for mother when we look at the mothers of the children with MPS and other disorders like that. The mothers who often say, I don't want my child to be disabled, so I'm not going to file for benefits until they've pretty much bankrupted the family. But what I'm concerned about is that the concerns that I've heard are, first of all, people with rare chronic conditions find so many ways of coping that when they say, I can do laundry, I can go to the grocery store, often it doesn't really mean that. I've had somebody tell me they could go to the grocery store and do their ADLs, when it turns out what they did was they went to the grocery store with their spouse, sat in the front of the store while the spouse shopped. They say they can bring the groceries in, really they sat on the front step. So the information that you're getting to start with isn't really the real information of what their bodies can do, it's of what their minds can do. Because for them, they're still grocery shopping, and I think it's very important that our forms really ask the questions in ways that are broken down, and that we ask the questions rather than just waiting for people to answer them. And I think that's part of what Bill was talking about. People say, I can do the laundry, but we don't ask how long it takes. And I think we have to have some questions that will sort for denial. Somebody with myasthenia gravis once told me that means doesn't even know it's a lie, and I think that's a big part of the problem that we run into. I think that when you have the initial claim denied, it feeds into the feeling of denial, especially for people who have faced a long diagnosis process, where the claim is denied and they say, you know, I'm really not that bad. I had a friend who had hemophilia, HIV, HCV, several joints that were fused and others that were replaced, tell me that he thought he could probably work and wasn't really sure that he was entitled to benefits. And I just think we have to understand that going into the process. Many join the large number of applicants who don't appeal the denial of their claim, because not only do they have to focus on the reluctance to say, I can't, but the feeling that they may not be entitled. And this causes them to stop and then start again later and go through the process. I also have grave concerns about women with rare chronic conditions, because again, they also have a long period of diagnosis. Often they're told it's in their head, until the diagnosis is finally found, and then when they don't work for 5 years, after the first year, they're involved with children. By the time the fifth year comes along, they lose their insured status and their excuse to say that they're not disabled. And then they're outside of the time when they'll actually be able to get benefits. I'm also concerned that there's a real need to expedite determinations and fully consider functional limitations at the earliest part of the process for those with rare chronic conditions, partially because the DDSs don't understand these conditions. Half the doctors don't even understand them. So we need to find a way of looking at the functional capacity at the earliest possible step rather than at the administrative law judge step, where the administrative law judge will find a way of understanding the residual functional capacity, but so much later. I think that if we can do more with the RFC at the earlier stages, we'll probably have, as Bill said, a savings and an offset. I'm convinced there are solutions, and I also believe that the savings realized from avoiding unnecessary appeals would at least partially offset the cost of implementing new procedures. I would also propose transitioning the use of ICD-9 diagnostic codes, which would make it easier to identify the rare conditions that could qualify for compassionate allowances. Because it will take a long time to implement, I would ask you to consider expanding and improving the current methods for flagging the rare chronic conditions. I would ask you to work closely with the medical professionals who specialize in rare chronic conditions, but I'm also concerned that a Dropbox may not be enough, that it may take human contact and words in order to explain this to the people making the decisions at the lower appeals. This can, if we use the questionnaires that are designed for more appropriate treating rather than one size fits all, I think that we will accomplish that a lot sooner. I think we need to, and this is, I think, the thing that I'm most convinced would make a difference. When we can't adjust the wind, we've got to adjust the sails. And I don't think that we can overhaul the entire Social Security Administration's processing, but I think we can meet it with better advocacy and advocacy that's available to people with rare chronic conditions. Our programs are rather unique in that we only deal with five rare chronic conditions. We understand Social Security, we understand the disease, we understand the people. And I think we need to have more groups available to people with rare chronic conditions who understand all three to assist the Social Security Administration in making decisions well and quickly. If we were to establish a panel of consumer advocates for rare disorders, either within Social Security, I did find when I was a public defender, one good prosecutor was better than 100 good public defenders, because if you have the person making the decision more educated and more able to handle it, the decisions come out better and faster, and it transfers to everyone else. Or from an agency such as NIH Office of Rare Diseases, or from an independent outside group, for example, National Organization of Rare Diseases, if we could house a group of specialized advocates that could assist other lawyers by providing briefs, as we often do to people who have hemophilia and have not asked for our services, they could assist in identifying the functional limitations, developing compassionate allowance guidelines for disability claimants with rare diseases. These consumer advocates could also make sure that unrepresented, and they concern me more than anyone, is the unrepresented client with a rare chronic condition that hasn't yet found the nonprofit organization which will explain things to them and has not found anyone to help understand that what they have will be understood if they keep going. We need to find ways of offering people that will help, perhaps in a pilot project that would assist the agency as well as the clients who are applying. Every denial letter needs to include a disclosure of what percentage of claims on average are approved or denied at each stage of the appeal process and what the average processing time is for the appeal. I think people get the letter and they say, see, I wasn't really entitled. I was wrong, especially after they've spent so much time getting a diagnosis where they were told, get a new job, something, it's you, it's really not your condition. It should also make clear that what the relevant waiting periods are for cash benefits and associated medical coverage from the date of onset. My feeling is that every month of delay in approving a disability claim that's ultimately allowed should result in corresponding reduction in those waiting periods. We've got to find a way of getting the benefits to the people. We are so grateful to have the invitation to come speak. I really believe that the main thing is we can't give up. We need to find creative and collaborative ways of bringing the stakeholders together in order to get a better health outcome. I think we all share the common goal. If we can join advocates, attorneys and non-advocates, the medical community, the voluntary health organizations, the governmental agencies, and I think something novel, corporate partners. There are so many corporations that put so much work into finding therapies that serve the people to give them better lives that need reimbursement sources so that the people can actually utilize them. I think that we could take some dollars from the corporate side, bring it in, and find a way. Once we have a diagnosis and an explanation within the time benefits, within the time frames, people will get their benefits and will get their products and enjoy a much healthier life. I think we also need a lot better look back at last date insured, especially for women. That's something that very much concerns me. I didn't quite understand it until I was a mom, how the first year you could say, I can't be disabled. I don't care what you call me. You cannot call me disabled. I have a child to take care of. And by the time you finally realize the child is not at home and you weren't doing what you really needed to, you were soliciting help from your family, your relatives, you most likely won't get your benefits, and that doesn't help the family. Those are benefits that you're entitled to. We need better look back. I think it's probably going to take putting private dollars in for representation, but I think they're there. I want to thank you again for giving me this chance to speak. If you ever decide to consider changing the name of disability, I think it would be a great thing. I think that really often we're looking at inconsistent worker status, and I think that the people who could get inconsistent worker status would be much more likely to apply, work when they could and not when they couldn't. Thank you so much for giving me this chance to speak.
Thank you very much. I wonder if I could ask the panelists to help me with a problem that I'm still trying to get my arms around, because I've probably had a typical experience, at least with physicians that help patients with rare diseases. I've always found them to be extraordinarily zealous advocates. When I was in biotech, I had the experience of being cornered in parking lots by doctors that were trying to demand that their patients get into clinical trials and that type of thing. And so the question of getting medical records, I guess I understand a little bit more in some of the larger general practice facilities. I wondered if you could all give me a little bit more of a sense for this particular population that we're focused on today, the rare diseases. Is it a real issue getting medical records on a timely basis? Does it depend on specialty? Are there things you could do? If there's any way you could kind of focus on that issue specifically for this population, I'd be grateful.
I think that it varies. I mean, certainly I've had contact with specialists, children's doctors in particular, just had a case involving Rett syndrome, where the doctors were very responsive, gave me their cell phone numbers, but could I get a letter out of them? Could I actually get them to put pen to paper and answer the questions that I had asked? That was harder. And I think part of it is this language issue. They would write me a letter, but it really wouldn't respond to the questions that I asked. They wanted to say the same things over again that they say to their colleagues, and that they'd put in their already prepared the pre-existing medical records. It was hard to get them to answer the questions around functional capacity for the child or the specific medical questions. They wanted to, they tried to, but it took a while for me to get that information from them, despite their cooperation. And sometimes, you know, doctors are only willing to give you the existing medical records. They're not willing, without charging you, to provide a statement. I mean, I'm a nonprofit. I can't pay $200-$300 for a prepared written statement or an RFC. It really varies. A lot of doctors are really helpful. Some doctors write more than others. I find the higher degree of the specialty, the less they write. the therapists will write. You know, the psychologists will write. But others, it's harder. So, you know, over the years, what I've tried to do, and I'm sure you have too, Bill, is to come up with questionnaires and check sheets that are very, very specific. You know, send people a copy of the listings.
Does that work substantially better, in your opinion, if it's a more automatic process like that?
Well, I mean, it does, to the extent that the information that you need can be had that way. When what you need is a little harder to get at, a little less objective, perhaps, if it's functional capacity information or some of the softer information in the listings. It's, you know, like severe. What does severe mean? Everybody has their own definition of what severe means, or what disability means for that matter, or what sedentary means. And so you spend a lot of time explaining what Social Security means by these terms. And it's just hard to get them to respond to what you want. I mean, moderate means something different to them than it does to Social Security. A moderate level of osteoporosis is pretty darn severe. It doesn't mean, you know, sort of severe. So you spend a lot of time explaining language.
I think there's also a problem in positive charting, where people are trying to chart positively in order to have the medication and have their own attitudes. Or, for instance, for someone like Ralph, who has 3 fused joints, if he's walking, he's ambulating well. So that's what goes into the file to Social Security, not really a good picture.
Yeah, and just to add on to what's been said already, I find that it really varies a lot in terms of getting medical information in a timely manner. Part of that has to do with the fact that, yes, we can pay for records, but we have a very convoluted system for doing it, and it involves sending tax forms back and forth and getting them to sign the form so that we can issue a check and then waiting for that check to clear, and they're waiting for the medical records people to pull the files. Often the medical records are handled by an outside agency that's going to do it on a first-come, first-served basis. I spend months trying to get medical records out of sources very often. Some doctors are really good about it. They'll fax their medical records right over. Others send me a bill and say, you know, we'll send you the records when we get your payment. In terms of trying to get the specific information that...
Is that legal? Do you operate just in Florida, or do you operate in other states as well?
We represent people all over the country.
All over the country. I mean, in most states, I mean, I think if a patient requests medical record, isn't the physician required to supply it?
They can charge.
They can charge them?
They can, and they do, believe me.
And what typically is the charge?
It varies a lot. Hospitals tend to be very high. They'll want to do a per-page charge, and hospital records tend to be voluminous. I just paid, or not me personally, but our program just recently paid something upwards of $300 for medical records for a child. So it can be very expensive, particularly when we're talking about people that don't have the financial means to do this on their own. Like I said, we have a corporate sponsor that pays for this stuff, but we have to go through their channels to get the checks issued. As far as getting the specific information that we're talking about, of these questionnaires and so forth.
Why don't we hold this and let the bell ring? I think since people are trying to listen long distance. I know from experience it doesn't last long. Yeah, we have a historic church right next door.